So it's great that we've got our international guest speaker to come and speak at the guideline session. I'm sure you've all heard Patty speak this morning, but Patty's an ID specialist, Professor of Microbial Diseases at UC Dublin, and Director of the UCD Centre for Experimental Pathogen Host Research. He chairs the EAC Society for Comorbidities Guidelines Panel and Director of Wellcome Trust HRB Irish Clinical Academic Training Program. And Patty's going to speak to us today about ageing with HIV and comorbidities, along with some other great topics that we hope you'll enjoy the session. So, Patty, please take us away. Thanks.
Thanks a million. So, again, I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me to speak. What I thought I'd try and do over the next 20 minutes or so is to put some of the thoughts that we have at a European level coming through on ageing research, kind of in the context of what we're doing within the European AIDS Clinical Society with guidelines. So a bit of it guidelines-driven, a bit of it probably more nebulous. With a focus on aging, I guess the thing about aging is that depending on what region of the world that you're in, the context of aging and its contribution to your clinical practice is going to differ. So obviously the epidemic in Australia that's been around for a long time means that you've got a large proportion of people that are over the age of 50, and therefore age-related issues are probably of greater importance than maybe some of the other countries around the world where either the epidemic is still evolving, in which case predominantly people are younger, or epidemics have been established but you're really only getting access to treatment, so longevity is only becoming an issue. The other thing about aging and HIV is that it's also quite gender specific. So for example, in the setting that I work in, we have about half of our patients are female, half of those would be of African origin. So therefore issues that would be gender specific and ethnicity specific with respect to aging become more important than maybe some countries like Australia and North America where the patient population remains predominantly men. We've had comorbidities within the EACS guidelines pretty much since we started doing EACS guidelines. We're now at version number 10, which you can see from the date is coming out in November 2019. So therefore, this is the only part of version number 10 that you're going to get to see. What I can say about version number 10 is that we now have 90 pages of guidelines that are focused on management of comorbidities, and it's the largest section within the guidelines, and it still continues to evolve. Within EACS, because we have a very diverse population, target population, the guidelines end up being very diverse, really covering all aspects of comorbidities. But if you do want to see more, you'll just have to come and join us in Basel for the EACS conference later on this year. So what I will be focusing on is the current version of the guidelines, which is version 9.1. Now, with aging, a lot of what we do in the guidelines is really driven by research. The largest aging study that I'm involved in is a cohort called the POPPY cohort. The POPPY cohort is a prospective multicenter cohort that spread between ourselves in Dublin and sites in London and the southeast of England. And it's led by Alan Winston, who's based at Imperial, and Caroline Sabin, who is based in UCL. It's quite an exciting cohort because we've learned from the mistakes of the past. We have an exposure group, which are older people living with HIV over the age of 50, and then two control groups. We've got a younger population of people living with HIV, and then another control group is an older population of volunteers who are HIV negative, but are broadly drawn from the same socio-demographic background as those participants living with HIV. And I think it's that choice of controls that I think makes these sort of studies more representative of what's actually going on at the level of the clinic. It's a large enough study. We've got just under 650 within the exposure group and roughly half in each of the two control groups. Reflecting the demographics of the clinics, you can see that the majority are men. That's really because the London epidemic is mainly men and MSM. And that's also reflected down in these data here, and predominantly Caucasian. But we do have representation from different risk groups, different genders and ethnicities, which enables us to be able to model the effect of gender and race on some of the outcomes. Now, one of the things that the POPPY studies really brought through is issues around mental health. And I think that mental health is really one of the main things that characterizes what it is to grow old with HIV, that differentiates a lot of populations living with HIV from the other control groups. And I think it's probably something that is underrepresented in approach to guidelines and probably also underrepresented in approach to clinical management. But I'll show you how you can't really escape from the impact of mental health issues on physical function. And I think if you're going to deal with comorbidities, you can't deal with the physical aspect of comorbidities in isolation and ignore the mental health issues. Prevalence of depression, much higher in those over the age of 50. In fact, much higher in both HIV positive groups compared to the HIV negative controls. But more importantly, when you look at association of depressive symptoms with comorbidities, so the more comorbidities you have here, the darker, you can see that you really have a much higher levels of comorbidities in those with a diagnosis of depression. Now, whether there's a chicken and egg scenario here, I'm not quite sure. Whether the burden of comorbidities is driving mental health issues or vice versa, we still don't know. But a clear signal there that I think is worthy of follow-up. We also have looked within the POPPY study in collaboration with another large aging study in Europe called AGE-HIV, which is run from Peter Rice in the Netherlands, to start to look at how comorbidities cluster together. And what we're starting to see with these sorts of clustering analyses is that there are broad groups of comorbidities that exist together and seem to be quite distinct. So here you can see comorbidities that tend to revolve around cardiovascular diseases. We've got comorbidities that tend to evolve around sexual health. And then we also have comorbidities that revolve around musculoskeletal problems. And I think it's this sort of clustering approach that you'll see as I go on with the talk is really going to start to define populations that are older living with HIV that cluster according to a specific clinical outcome. And I think the important message is that not everyone who's growing old with HIV necessarily needs to be unwell. And I think that that's a message that we need to bring through in the clinic. What we need to be able to do clinically is to identify those individuals who are disadvantaged and growing old with HIV and target the interventions appropriately. So not all comorbidities are the same, and not everyone is going to end up with a comorbidity. Though there is that link between mental health and physical health. If you look at the SF36 questionnaire within the POPPY study, you can see that the physical summary scores from these quality of life scores are much, much worse in those that have a history of depression. And you can see how different that is between those over the age of 50 who aren't living with HIV, again, showing this interaction between mental health and physical health. We've looked at that within the Upbeat cohort. For those of you who were there this morning, the Upbeat cohort is a cohort that we built in Dublin that was like a prelude to the POPPY. It wasn't age-focused, but it does have a population with and without HIV that are closely demographically not matched but brought together. We've got much longer follow-up within the Upbeat cohort, and within the Upbeat cohort we've also been collecting measures on quality of life. Again, you can sort of categorize these broadly into physical health and mental health. And when you look at 5 years of follow-up within the POPPY study and you look to see what aspects of quality of life really differentiate those living with HIV versus those without HIV, it's declines in physical function and declines in mental health. So really from a quality of life point of view, I think we're starting to get a picture emerging of the importance of mental health to overall comorbidity burden. So what you have is mental health and depression are commoner. You have these associations between mental health and presence of comorbidities, and these comorbidities do tend to cluster, giving rise to this sort of risk profile. And really, I think it's this combination of physical function and mental health decline in people living with HIV that really starts to draw a signal as to where our focus should be. As a result, I mean, this is the third iteration of the EACTS guidelines, where we actually give guidance to HIV physicians in terms of how to screen and diagnose mental health issues, specifically around depression. But I still think that this is an area that hasn't been that well researched, especially from the point of view of intervention and needs greater attention. So the second part of the talk, I just want to go through some of the clinical consequences and again provide a few insights into what HIV and aging I think is all about. And I hear people using terms premature aging or people using terms accelerated aging. I think these terms are thrown around without people really thinking about the consequences. I wouldn't want to have a condition where I'm constantly being told I'm going to prematurely age if that's not actually the case. And certainly when you look at the data for HIV and aging, there are very specific differences between premature and accelerated based on specific conditions. And we should, as care providers, be a bit more nuanced in terms of our approach. Once again, telling not everyone is going to end up with a premature aging profile, and within specific conditions, some fit with premature aging and some fit with more accelerated aging. So what's the difference? Well, if you look at a control population, an accelerated aging profile is where, for that condition, there will be a progressive increase in either the frequency or the severity of that condition, which is really unrelenting. A premature aging is slightly different in that what you have is you have a seminal event. Now, that could be acquiring HIV, or it could be acquiring a mental health diagnosis, or acquiring some sort of specific event. But then after that event leaves you at a disadvantage, your progression after that pretty much mirrors what's going on with the general population. And then lastly, you can have a profile that is both accelerated and premature, where you would have a specific event, but as a result of that event, you're left disadvantaged, but your rate of progression is faster. I'll give you a few examples. A good example of accelerated aging in HIV is cardiovascular disease. Cardiovascular disease, number one cause of death in people over the age of 45 living with HIV here, virally suppressed. Very complex idiopathogenesis, but the bottom line is we need to try and identify those people that are most at risk. And when you look at the biological picture that underlies cardiovascular disease and HIV, all of the signals point towards an accelerated profile that's mostly driven through inflammation. So it can be inflammation through microbial translocation. That in turn drives really the seminal cell here, which is the monocyte macrophage of the innate immune system, which is involved in the atherosclerotic plaque formation. But you also have contributions from HIV, platelet function, as I discussed this morning, as well as lipid dysfunction, such as HDL dysfunction. And all of these things work together to create a biological environment that promotes accelerated atherogenesis. Now, you don't need to be a genius to realize that if you add smoking in on top of this, it's not a good thing. And certainly smoking, for most of the conditions that we associate with aging and HIV, constantly drops out as a very good predictor of a worse outcome. So what can you do to map all these together? Well, as scientists and as clinicians, we constantly want the one biomarker, the one thing that you can take in a blood test, send away, and it'll come back saying, Paddy Mallon's at increased risk of getting the disease. The reality is that you're not going to get that in these complex type of environmental diseases. So we need to find a way to use the technology that we have to actually be able to differentiate a population into those that are at risk and those that aren't at risk. And we've started to do this. This is an example of an approach that we used in a population in Malawi. So this is a population of people initiating treatment. And what we have is we've got this pulse wave velocity follow-up as a surrogate marker for cardiovascular health. And we assayed a number of different immunological and inflammatory markers at baseline to see, could we cluster people into different groups, and then could we define different outcomes? Now, the principal component analysis cluster identified three broad clusters, two of which were very pro-inflammatory. One small one in particular was particularly pro-inflammatory and actually ended up with a worse profile on pulse wave velocity as a cardiovascular outcome. And this is, I think, the first real attempt in HIV to try and take a population, use biological information to be able to classify people into different clusters, and then see if one of those clusters predicts either a better or a worse outcome. And I think this is an approach that's going to continue as time goes on and as this research field more develops. Not surprisingly, when you look at management of cardiovascular diseases within the EACTS guidelines, it really is, there's no one thing that you can do. It's a joined up approach where you have to look at things like general cardiovascular health, hypertension, dyslipidemia, and glucose metabolism, as well as body composition, all to try and improve general health, because this is a systemic condition. So what about the premature aging? Well, a good example of a premature aging in which there's a cardinal event is bone disease. Now, bone disease, as I said this morning, the majority of the action in bone disease happens in the first 12 months after treatment initiation. Thereafter, there's very little going on from the evidence that we have from a number of different trials. This isn't driven by untreated HIV. It's really just a seminal event related to antiretroviral therapy. After that, you can see really parallel lines when you look within the upbeat cohort over 3 years about what happens to bone mineral density. So no significant differences in the change in bone mineral density, whether you're HIV positive or HIV negative, provided that you're virally suppressed. So why does this happen? Well, the key there, again, when we go back into biology, is we can explain this very defined loss of BMD by looking at bone metabolism. And within bone metabolism, we have bone resorption and bone formation that are very tightly linked in an equilibrium. And provided that they remain tight in an equilibrium, then bone density or bone turnover should be normal. If you get delinkage of that, either increased bone formation or increased bone resorption, and that equilibrium is lost, you'll get either net bone loss or net bone gain. And when we looked in the studies, what tends to happen in that early treatment initiation phase is you get a rapid increase in markers of bone resorption, so that's where you're losing bone. And bone formation markers, it takes up to 12 months for them to catch up. So you have this gap between month 3 and month 12, where you have delinkage of bone metabolism, and that is the time period during which we see most bone loss. So to put it a bit more simply, you have an equilibrium, good bone turnover, treatment initiates, you get increased bone resorption, this delinkage, and then by 12 months it resets itself, albeit at a higher level. But that higher level correlates with the stabilization of bone mineral density. And that pretty much explains everything that we've seen in the clinical trials. If that's the case, then can you switch it off? Well, if you switch off bone metabolism using bisphosphonates in the blue here, single shot of zoledronic acid, you completely avoid that bone loss. So this is a good example of science making sense. How do you translate that into guidelines? Well, these are the EACTS guidelines around bone disease. All of our focus on who to screen for bone disease is age-related, and it's also focused around the time of treatment initiation. So this is how we can translate what science that we have into guidelines that can be used at a practical level within the clinic. Lastly, we have accelerated and premature aging. Now this is a little bit more nebulous, but this is where I think the whole inflammaging and immune dysfunction picture settles in. And I think that the cardinal event here is acquisition of HIV infection. But the consequences are really unremitting on the immune system. And we're starting to get some insights into the implications of this in a treated population in relation to outcome. And the issue here is classically we've been focusing on the CD4 count. A lot of us have been getting CD8 counts for years on our reports, haven't really known what to do with them. But we sort of look at a patient like this that has a good CD4 reconstitution going from a very low edge, but over time really has very poor overall immune reconstitution, low CD4 percentages and persistent high CD8 percentages. And the question up until recently was, does it matter that we don't know if this matters? We know that it doesn't look right, but we really don't know what consequence it has. Well, I think now we're starting to get good data to show that it does matter. Certainly those who are on treatment with a low CD4, CD8 ratio are disadvantaged from the point of view of a clinical outcome. Probably the best study to show this is the START study. I'm not going to go through this. You all know the design of the START study, I'm sure. But when you look within the START study at predictors of morbidity and mortality, you have predictors related to inflammation and coagulation. But more recently, they showed that the low CD4, CD8 ratio was also associated with a higher risk of AIDS and non-AIDS mortality. And that persisted even in models that control for IL-6 and D-dimer. Just within our own cohort, we looked at about 700 patients, and we looked at all of the different non-AIDS comorbidities and people who were consistently virologically suppressed. And you can see that one of the main predictors was this sort of stepwise association between a lower CD4, CD8 ratio and a higher incidence of these non-AIDS illnesses. And this has been shown by a number of studies around the world. So what is it? What is the CD4, CD8 ratio representing? Well, what it's probably representing is an aging immune system. And certainly there's been a lot of interest in immunosenescence over the years. We've looked at it within the upbeat cohort, where we've taken cells from patients and looked at both CD4 and CD8 T-cell senescence. And within this cohort, what we can see, those that are living with HIV have a lower CD4-CD8 ratio and have more T cell senescence, and that's both in the CD4 and the CD8 compartment. And there's a very good concept in the aging literature called the immune risk phenotype, which constitutes these two entities. And you can see that the proportion of people living with HIV with this immune risk phenotype is a lot higher than the HIV negative, in the HIV negative population. So what drives the senescence? Well, very quickly, it's driven by associations between a low CD4-CD8 ratio and CMV seropositivity. And these are two very useful clinical markers that we can use in the clinic to sort of identify a group of people that we can guess already have an immunosenescent underlying T-cell phenotype. And that probably constitutes a group of people that require more close monitoring. This is true for both CD4 and CD8 T-cell senescence. So how do you put all this together? Well, this is the proposal that that really our center is currently working on and continues to work on, where if you look at a population living with HIV that are getting older, you will have some people towards the red here who have clinical and biological characteristics that represent a worse or a more disadvantaged and potentially worse outcome that require closer monitoring. But at the same time, at the other end of the spectrum, you would have a group of people that, for all intents and purposes, are aging healthily. And I think our focus clinically needs to be is identifying these biomarkers that represent disadvantaged people and implementing closer monitoring in those individuals to improve outcomes. So just like to finish up by acknowledging the guys in the group who helped with generating all of this data, our current 2019 comorbidities panel, my vice chair, Alan Winston, and Aoife Cotter, who does the majority of the legwork actually getting this version of the guidelines together. And I hope to see you all in Basel in 2019. Thanks a lot for your attention.
Um,